The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. Today, I am joined by Joe Knepp from Mauritania. And Joe's from Pittsburgh, and he studied law, and he did his JD and MBA there in Pittsburgh. And he worked in finance and wealth management for about 7 years before joining the Foreign Service. And he brought that background to not only his job in a lot of management tours, but actually to what we are talking about today, which is flipping, renovating, buying, selling vacation homes in the United States from abroad. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tanya. I'm really happy to be on it.
Yeah, I was actually very interested to hear your story because, real estate can be a very active thing, and especially flipping and renovating, right? I mean, like most people think of HGTV, you've got all these shows and, you know, there's all these like contractors and things and all these things going wrong. And I think for most people in the Foreign Service, they think, how on earth could you do that from abroad? Tell us, how did you even get started with this?
Yeah, it's actually kind of an interesting story, which I think will resonate with a lot of Foreign Service officers. We're, like you said, my wife and I are originally both from Pittsburgh. And when we first joined the Foreign Service, we were like, you know, wouldn't it be great to have a place that we could go back to during home leave or on vacation to R&Rs, where all of our friends could come to us so we don't have to do that crazy thing where you try to see, you know, three different family groups all over the country in 2 weeks and you're just miserable by the time your R&R is over, you want to have a second vacation. We wanted to avoid that. So we said, let's find a place that's near Pittsburgh and near DC. And so there's a part of Western Maryland that is right where West Virginia, Maryland, and Pennsylvania meet, west of Cumberland. And there's a lake there. It's the largest lake in Maryland called Deep Creek Lake. And my wife's family had gone down there a lot in the 70s. I'd actually never been there, but it's about 2 hours from Pittsburgh, about three and a half from DC and Baltimore. And we thought, you know, this makes perfect sense. Like our family can come down. If we're ever based in DC, we can drive over there. So we went for it. We decided to go take a look. So we went down to Deep Creek and we found a realtor, which is always an interesting process.
Did you actually find a good one out of the gate, or did you have to test a few more out?
So what I did was I was looking for volume. So I had worked with a lot of realtors in Pittsburgh when I was doing wealth management that we would do cross referrals with each other. And mm-hmm. the folks that did real estate they took it seriously, did it as a profession and had large volume were usually the folks that I liked working with. I wasn't so much interested in working with somebody who did it as kind of a part-time job.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I looked up who had the biggest volume in Deep Creek, and there were two guys, and I emailed both of them, and one of them didn't get back to me, and the other one did. And so his name is John Bell. He's now the top realtor in Deep Creek. He did over $200 million in sales last year.
Ooh, that is a lot of houses to sell. Ooh.
Yeah, he's doing well. And we actually are business partners now in another side gig. John showed us around, and we did kind of, at that time, we were just looking for something for our family to go to. It wasn't an investment per se. We certainly wanted to mm-hmm. rent it out to offset the costs, but we weren't really gunning for the investment. It was more something for us. So we found like two or three, four bedroom, 2,000 square foot homes that were in our price range. I think at that time we were looking at like the 280s. And they were fine. But then my wife actually found a house that was an REO. For those who aren't as familiar, REO stands for real estate owned, but basically it's a house that's owned by a bank. And this was 2012.
Foreclosure.
Exactly, foreclosure. So this is 4 years out from 2008. And Deep Creek and many vacation markets tend to lag the national market, the residential market. And so 2008 was still very alive in 2012 in Deep Creek. So there were a lot of foreclosures. The market was down probably 70% below its 2005, 2006 numbers in terms of market value. Yeah, no, they just, things were terrible. But a great opportunity. So there was a house on the market for $305,000. It was well over our budget, but it was huge. Four stories, 5,000 square feet.
Whoa.
Lakeview, you know, relatively new construction. But nobody wanted to buy it. And the reason nobody wanted to buy it was sight unseen. You couldn't go inside. As is, no inspection. And in the pictures, you could see a crack running from the peak of the house all the way down through all four stories.
Oh, God.
So
that's terrible, Joe. I have a feeling I know where this story ends up. But yes, please continue.
So I snuck into the crawl space. And I found that they had actually set the pillars incorrectly. It was cinder block. And cinder block is strong vertically and not as strong horizontally. And it was laid on its side. So we bought the house for $295,000. We fixed the crack for a couple coats of paint and three new cinder blocks. We ended up having a house that was worth, it was fantastic. So all we did to that house, we didn't renovate it. We just decorated it, started renting it, and used it for about a year and a half. So the story that about the crawl space that's interesting is I didn't put the cover back on the crawl space. And whoops, and a mama bear moved into the house and had three cubs living under our house for the first 3 months. So
by the time you closed.
Exactly.
You cannot make this stuff up.
That's a crazy story. It's crazy.
I'm sorry. I gotta go back, Joe. Like,
sure.
How on earth were you crawling in a crawl space? I mean, at that point, like, if it's sight unseen and you can't, I mean, listeners, please do not try this at home. But I mean, aren't you technically trespassing on a property? I don't want to say it like that, but
technically you are. Yes.
We won't say when this was because since you own the house, like, it doesn't really matter now. But yeah, okay. But crawling in the crawl space, you weren't afraid that there was going to be, like, I don't know, critters down there or something weird? I mean, this sounds like very, I don't know. You're an intrepid soul, I think.
Well, it was the summer. I knew there probably weren't bears under there. And, you know, it was fine. So anyway, we went in there and we eventually got DNR to the Department of Natural Resources to get the bears out once it was safe and the cubs wouldn't be injured. But you could actually hear the mama bear breathing through the floorboards.
Wow, that would be a little much for me. But I mean, it sounded like you got a fabulous deal. I mean, to think about like a four-story, 5,000 square foot Lakeview home for $295,000 seems unthinkable now in DC, right? So, but I mean, this is just the beginning of your story. I mean, this was just a R&R vacation home leave property, but then it turned into more. What happened next?
Yeah, so we put it on Zillow. We listed the house on Zillow as a make me move, which for those who aren't familiar, this is not a traditional MLS listing. It's just on Zillow. It's nowhere else. And we just did it. I put a ridiculous price. I think it was like $565. And I was like, nobody's going to offer this, you know, whatever. It's fine. And within a month or two, somebody did. So we ended up selling that house. I think we owned it for 16 months total, closing to closing.
No.
And we sold it for $515, I think it was.
And you were hooked after that, I bet. After that
I was hooked, and we were only into this house for like $15,000 or $20,000, and we just walked away with $200,000. in profit.
Crazy, so, crazy.
Crazy, right? So we then were like, well, what are you going to do with the taxes? I mean, this is going to be terrible. Well, then we came our good old friend 1031 exchange.
Yes.
Which is every real estate investor's favorite tool, although there's some downsides, mm-hmm. which we can talk about at the end. And I had to do a 1031 exchange. So I was like, all right, well, I got to make this work. So I found a split lakefront. So this is a property that has some lakefront with a dock, but then the house is set back. There's other homes and then the house, which is a common occurrence at Deep Creek because you have a lot of just patched together lots from an earlier era. So this home was built in the 1970s and it was a ranch. I mean, you could not live in it. And we bought it for, I think it was $185,000. And we were able to use the profits from the sale of the last house. But in order to be able to do the reno, because I needed another $300,000 or $400,000 to do the renovation, I had to use hard money, which was scary. So for those who've never mm-hmm. done hard money lending, you basically, you're borrowing not from a bank, you're essentially borrowing from another person or from a company. In this case, it was a company.
Yeah.
And I had to pay, I don't know, I think 15% interest, and there's certain points you have to pay up front. It's very expensive. And it only, the mortgage is only good, I think, for a year. In this case, I had to complete the project in a year. So we tried to get contractors to do it, to bid on it, you know, to do the whole reno. But the prices were crazy. I mean, it was like $600,000, $700,000 to do what we wanted to do. So I just hired my own crew, put ads in Craigslist, and found laborers who were willing to work for, you know, $10, $15 an hour. And this was all from overseas. I was in Cote d'Ivoire at this point.
Wait, and so there was nobody on site like to vet these people at all? Like, how did you even know that they were doing a good job?
I would call them every day on video calls and have them walk me around the house and show, you know, what did you guys do today? Okay, great. And that's how we did it. I bought all the materials, had everything delivered on site. We did a complete gut, new roof. We knew, I mean, everything, the siding, the electrical, the plumbing, new well. We ended up finishing out the basement, which had three collapsing walls. This is why this house was so cheap.
Oh, lovely. You're blowing my mind, Joe. Like, so you literally did not have any kind of project manager or anything on site. Like, you just got a bunch of guys on Craigslist and then like did video calls. This is wild. And it all turned out okay? Like you didn't have any bad experiences?
No, it was a disaster. It was very difficult.
Okay, good, because I was like, wait a minute. This just sounds a little bit much, but yes, please go ahead.
No, I mean, it was a disaster, of course, because you have to redo things. Things aren't done correctly. I ended up firing crews. I mean, I don't think I've ever had a job where I didn't have to fire a crew at some point. Bring in different people. There were delays, all of the things that, all the nightmares that you can imagine when you do a major renovation like that occurred.
Yes, because even when you have people on site, like you tell contractors one thing, you're like, okay, the tile needs to be installed this way, and you show it to them, and then you come and then some days you're like, this is upside down. They're like, but that's what you said. I said, that is not what I said. So like, even when you're there on site, like I find like the communication is so important, like. You usually like have to show them sometimes. Like, and so, I mean, I can't even imagine trying to do it from overseas on video calls. But you know, I gotta hand it to you. Like you were brave. You were ballsy. You're like, I'm just going to do this thing. And you know, we're just gonna make it work. Right. And so, you know, you got these guys, you had to fire some, but it sounds like some work got done. And then, you know, you would like take two steps forward, a step back, and then what did the renovation actually look like? Did you actually go out and see it at any point during the project?
No. I think I only...
Nice.
And actually, I bought it sight unseen. I bought it over online as well. I hadn't seen the property when I purchased it.
Uh-huh. And actually, can I ask a little bit about that? Because did you like, cause you seem like a very numbers oriented guy, right? Like, did you just decide that like, even with the risks, even with, you know, some overages in terms of like contracting work, that like the numbers worked out? And so you were therefore okay with it? Or are you just generally sort of a guy that's like, hey, I think I can make this work? Like, what was sort of your thinking behind it?
No, and thank you for asking that. That's exactly the reasoning. That was exactly the thought process. So I knew that if I finished this house even close to what I wanted, to quality that I wanted, it would be worth $600,000 or $700,000. So my thought process was, all right, if I bought it for X, I put in 200, 250, 300, whatever it was. There's definitely,
you're still a wide margin of profit there, that you can make many, many mistakes and not lose your shirt.
Right. And there were things that I was able to cut corners on that I like to research the heck out of things, you know? So that really made a big difference in our ability to make that cost effective. And I'll give you some examples. So those three walls that were collapsing because of, they call it hydrostatic pressure. Basically, it's on the downward slope of a hill, and water's pressing up against the walls. So these walls were all collapsing, and all the quotes to fix this were to dig out around the foundation, restack the stone, and put in a French drain. Well, that's a $25,000 or $30,000 job back then. Now it's even more. I just used carbon fiber straps. They cost like $1,000. They are stronger than steel, and you anchor them into the footer, you anchor the top into the header, and they'll hold back all of that water for 1/35th of the price. So that's what we did.
And you just figured this out by researching, like Dr. Google?
Yeah, exactly. Like, how do you fix bowed walls? And, you know,
You're like in what, like Sudan or something? Or no, Cote d'Ivoire, right? You're in Cote d'Ivoire at this point, and you're like in Abidjan, you know, researching carbon fiber straps.
Exactly. And what was funny about it was, I couldn't get the building inspectors to pass the straps because they're like, oh, I don't know about this. I've never seen this before. I had to actually, it cost more to hire an engineer to convince the inspectors that it would work than the straps cost. But yeah, and now it's a very common thing.
Like a structural engineer to come in and like pass it then.
Exactly. And that's what had to happen. Yeah. What else did we do there? That was it. We used, at that time, split packs, you know, we all know split packs from overseas. I mean, they're like the most common form of air conditioning and heating.
Yeah, but sure.
In the States, it wasn't as common. It's getting more
super common. Yeah.
Yeah. So I used some inverter type Mitsubishi heat packs for the HVAC. So rather than doing a central system for $30,000, I installed those for $4,000, and it was enough to heat the whole house. So things like that, we were able to save a lot of money on. And so that project, we ended up selling for, I think, $650, something like that, $665. So we made a decent amount of money on that, too.
And this is back in what year now? Because I think just to give people some context in terms of, because you said, you know, it was about, what, like 2012 when you first started looking. So it was still like the real estate market was depressed, right? And then at this point, when you're doing your second project, what is this, like 2013, 2014, something like that?
Yeah, it was around then. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then, I mean, and yet you've continued, right? Like you're still doing projects there even now in Deep Creek?
We are, yeah. So we went from that project, we did another 1031 with a lakefront house, a lakefront property that was just a crazy house. Like it was 7,700 square feet. So just a huge house on the lake.
But oh my goodness.
It had been put together with three different additions by the homeowner. So I'm sure you've seen this kind of thing where nobody wanted to buy it because it just didn't make sense.
It's like the Franken house. Yes.
Yeah. Like my favorite part was they had put an addition where the master bathroom had a staircase that went into a bathroom above it with no doors. So you could, You're just like, who would do this?
It's like an echo chamber going down, like, oh boy.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, you know, there's a lot of style choices out there that, let's say, are questionable sometimes when homeowners just add on random things.
Exactly. So we took that house, rationalized it, added an indoor pool and a movie theater with an addition.
Of course, because of course you would do that, right?
Well, add an addition to the house that already has three.
Why not? Yeah. Why not? The more the merrier.
Yep. So that at that point, after that house, we had enough equity that we were able to tap into to do, start doing multiple houses.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And can I ask, Joe? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think people are probably listening in their car or at home or whatever, and they're thinking, where on earth did he find the time to do all of this? Because, you know, most people, at least if I get on Dr. Google and I'm like researching hydrostatic pressure against walls of a house, I may not come up with carbon fiber straps for quite a while. But where do you find time to do this, right? Because like a lot of overseas jobs, it's intense. There's pressure. Like, how do you manage that? And also, too, you're in a different time zone, right? So like, are you getting up in the middle of the night to talk to people or really early in the morning? Like what was like logistically, what was that process like managing these kinds of projects from overseas?
Yeah, it's, the time zone actually helps because my routine is usually to get home around 6:30, have dinner with the family, get the kids to bed. And then around 7:30, I usually work until about 11 or 11:30. On whatever projects I'm working on. And then sometimes on the weekend, but I try not to work too much on the weekends. And so that's the time you need. It doesn't take, and it depends too, because there's sometimes you'll be in the phase of a project where it's crazy. And then there's other times where you're waiting for permits or you're
and
waiting
it's dead.
For,
yep.
You just don't do anything for a while.
Please turn my utilities on. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it's not always 40 hours a week or 25 hours a week of this. Mm-hmm. So the time zone actually was an advantage.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Cause I guess, you know, especially since you've done, you know, quite a few Africa tours, it makes sense that like, you know, your evenings would be still, you know, working business hours during the day in the United States. So it actually, yeah, like you said, it's an advantage. I'm curious because you seem like a very, like I said, intrepid, I think is the word, like intrepid soul in that you're just like, I'm just going to figure this out. Right. And then you're like, I'm going to crawl in the crawl space and, oh, there's bears. I'll just figure that out too. And, oh, there's this hydrostatic pressure problem. And you just don't seem like problems faze you. And you're just like, oh, I'll just figure this out and, you know, move on to the next thing. And I think a lot of people would be really out of their comfort zone having to deal with any of that. I'm just curious, when these kinds of problems would come up, what was sort of your thought process or like mindset about it? Because it seems like part of your success is to just, you know, find whatever problem comes to you. You're just like, okay, I got this. I'm going to figure it out. Can you speak to that a little bit? Because I think a lot of people, they don't actually get started because they're worried about all the things that could happen. And it sounds like pretty much everything that could happened to you. And then some. What would you say to people who are kind of considering a project that's kind of out of their element?
Well, I think one of the things I remind myself is that home renovation, flipping, home acquisition, none of it's rocket science, right? I mean, you can figure out the numbers just from spending some time on Zillow, which nowadays is a pastime for a lot of people. So you get a sense of the market. You get a sense of, as we said earlier, if I buy at this price, I know I can sell at this price. And so I just have to fit the reno into, you know, this third price or this third category. Mm-hmm. And then I think to myself, you know, if these guys on HGTV can figure out this problem, I can probably figure it out too. And there's so much information that's available to us on the internet that frankly, the average contractor doesn't use. They go down mm-hmm. to, in my case, it's 84 Lumber. They go down to 84 Lumber, they go down to Lowe's, and they're like, what's on the shelf? Okay, I'm going to use this. And they don't do the research because they don't have time. And it's just right. not part of their mentality of, you know, I'm going to go and I'm going to make this, I'm going to fix this. So mm-hmm. that ability to do a little bit more research, think a little bit more, has always helped. And then the other part
served you well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's always good resources. You know, I mentioned John Bell, he's so successful at what he does because he's not just a realtor. I mean, he puts people in contact with all the resources they need. And he was always right. a helping hand for me when, if I ever really got in a bind, I would call him and be like, John, I don't know how to fix this. Like, you know what? A lot of the problems that were some of the most difficult were not mechanical issues or physical issues. It was, I can't get this permit. You know, I can't get this HOA approved to do X. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got a house.
City bureaucratic red tape.
Exactly. Like, I've got a house. This happened to me. I had a house that was finished. It was over a $2 million house. It was finished. And I couldn't rent it because I couldn't get a license because of something. I don't even remember what it was. I think it was a sprinkler fitting or something. Oh, I know what it was.
Something really small and stupid. Yeah.
Yeah. It was the fireplace. They had told me to put in a B vent, which is a vent straight up the chimney. And it was supposed to be a direct vent. So I had to redo the entire chimney for like $20,000. It took 2 months. So you get those kind of things that happen, and they are the ones that can be the most frustrating. So I always tell people, because people ask me about this, you know, should I do it? Should I get into it? You know, make sure your numbers make sense. That's the number one thing. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a 20 or 30% cushion after you've calculated your costs, don't do it. It's a bad project. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. And then the second thing is, just be ready to push through. Like, you're going to go over budget. You're going to have times where...
My experience too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, there was one Christmas, I remember this so well, where we were way over budget on that house I was telling you about with the indoor pool. Mm-hmm. And where I was literally using credit cards to buy stuff. I mean, it was that bad.
Ooh, scary.
Yeah.
And you're a wild man, Joe. Wild man.
I was like, all right, we're going to have to go lean on Christmas presents this year until we can finish this house because it's that bad.
Wow.
And then we turned the corner and it ended up being, you know, the biggest windfall we ever made was on that house. But it was really scary at that point.
Sometimes with big risk comes big rewards, right? I mean, and other times big failures. But it sounds like, you know, you're success has been based on lots of research, pushing through, figuring it out. And also, you know, you mentioned your realtor because, you know, obviously I'm an agent and your agent's kind of like the team captain, right? Like, they have connections, a network, people that they've worked with for many years, especially people who've been in the market a long time. And it sounds like this guy that you associated yourself with knows everybody, right? Like, he knows you know, the city people, and he can tell you, oh yeah, do this because, you know, he's doing things too. So I'm curious. So what started out, right, like as a vacation property, then turned into, oh, we're going to flip this house. And then, oh, we're going to 1031, the proceeds into another house and flip that house. And then we're going to do multiple projects. And, you know, what are you doing today now? Where has that led you? Because also the market has changed quite a bit from 2012, 2014. I mean, I have a friend who just sold his place in Deep Creek, and it was staggering the amount of money that he sold it for. I mean, his is lakefront too, but, so are you, I mean, and they're really, at least from what I see around, there are not a lot of foreclosures. Prices are not 70% down. So are you just making less on the margin, or like, how have you adapted to the changes in the real estate market, changes in financing, you know, changes in, you know, many things since 2012, 2014?
Mm-hmm. No, it's a great question. So we decided somewhere around 2016, 17 to stop selling and to build a rental portfolio. So we had always been renting in the vacation market as sort of a transition from the renovation stage to the sales stage, because unlike residential rentals, vacation rentals actually appreciate if it has a history of being rented out. So it helps build the sale value because people want an established history. So we would rent it, get a little bit of established rental, and then sell. But the rents we were getting were so good, and we had enough capital built up at that point that we didn't need to sell. So we actually got to one point in 2020 where we had, I think we had four homes at one point, that were all generating really nice rents. But then the pandemic happened and the sale prices became insane. And somewhere around the beginning of this year, I said, you know what? I'm listing everything. I'm putting it all up. So we've sold all of our houses in about a month. I'll have sold all the entire portfolio.
Wow. And that must have been an exciting ride.
It was. I'm not looking forward to paying taxes next year, but yes.
No, I was going to say, yeah, the ride is fun at the beginning. And then when you pay the tax bill, it's like, ouch. But yeah, to see those houses just go flying off the market at the prices that, I mean, I was seeing, woo, yes. Exciting.
Exactly. Very exciting. But then I was like, well, what am I going to do with this gains? I want to stay in the market. And I'm not gonna, I don't do 1031s anymore because I've moved into new construction. So I only do new builds. I shouldn't say only. I just bought a property last week that I'm going to do a rental on. But I pretty much only do new builds. The reason being there's nothing out there that's worth buying. I mean, in terms of price.
Yeah.
It's just too
expensive. The prices have gotten bid up so much.
Yep. And so I started a construction company and got my builder's license. And so now I'm building homes for myself and for other people. So that's what we're doing. Yeah, we're doing all new builds at Deep Creek.
I'm a little blown away because I'm like, did you do this all overseas? Like you just continued doing it overseas? Like you didn't come by Deep Creek at any point, like even for like R&Rs or anything like that, just to like check on things? You pretty much just the majority of the time just ran it from whatever country you were at?
Yeah, no, we've never done a DC tour. I've been overseas the whole time. we just come back. Yeah, we just come back every once in a while and check in on things. But it's actually one of the
stay at one of your houses.
Exactly. It's one of the beautiful things that's come out of the pandemic is people's willingness to do things remotely.
Yes, so I agree.
It's much easier today than it was even a year ago to talk to a client who wants to build a house who's okay with never meeting his builder. People are okay with that, and I don't do it by myself. John, who I mentioned, is my partner in the company, so he's on the ground. No, it's very doable. We also partnered with Lindell Cedar Homes. They're a custom kit home company. So they do most of the construction management. They deliver the kits. So a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of the actual site management, we have a team that does all of that. So it's actually gotten easier. Oddly, doing the construction company is easier than doing the renos ever were.
And why is that? Is that just because it's a more professional outfit because there's a system and process in place versus trying to manage kind of like motley crews of laborers, or like what's the reason?
I'm a big believer, and I think any contractor who's moved from renos to new homes will tell you this. It's a lot easier to build a new home. It's just hands down, it's easier because you have a set of plans that are concrete. You're not getting into a wall and going, oh boy, what's inside there? you know exactly what you're getting into from day one. And most people who do renovations don't use architects. They don't use designers. I actually do now. I use architects and designers. Even when I'm doing a reno, I have 100% design before we swing a hammer. And that's
so
just something
important.
I learned. Yeah.
Smart move. Very smart move. Because honestly, as a real estate agent, I have seen, on the other hand, what people do when they just sort of DIY it. And there are reasons houses don't sell. And a lot of times it's because the owners made the wrong design choices, because design really matters. So, yeah.
I couldn't agree more. And it goes back to what you were saying about managing the contractors. It's a lot easier to manage a contractor when they have a set of plans to refer back to versus just Joe's idea that exists in his head but doesn't exist on paper. So when you're building a new home, you have the set of plans. When you're doing a kit home, that's lovely because everything's already on site. You don't have to worry about the supply chain issues or, oh boy, I forgot to buy that. Now, where do I get it from? So yeah, and having the professionals, we have a structural engineer who works for us. We have an architect who works for us, who are all on the ground handling the day-to-day. So for me, it's more of just some of the conceptual stuff, the design, which I enjoy, that part of it.
Interesting. I mean, I would think, and to look out into the future, right? It sounds like you're very happy balancing kind of like your foreign service career and your construction company, right? Is this sort of the goal for now? Or, I mean, do you have some plans at some point, like, I don't know, to, you know, leave the department, whether it's through retirement or whatever it is, and then do construction full time? Or do you like the fact that there's a balance? I mean, I'm curious kind of what you foresee for the next like 5 or 10 years in your sort of career path.
Yeah, no, I kind of like the balance. I enjoy being a management officer. I actually have found that doing this construction stuff has actually helped me in my career as a management officer. My last position, I was dual hatted GSO facilities. So I was literally the facilities manager. Just having some knowledge of construction practices, of renovation practices, of, you know, what do we need to do to fix this was really helpful. And then in terms of acquiring properties as the GSO, I think I have a decent eye for it. And I like to do a little bit more of a make ready than maybe some embassies do. But, you know, we like to make the houses as in our pool as comfortable as for people as we can. And I think my ability to do that is definitely helped by having learned these things, doing this other thing that has nothing to do with the State Department. In terms of my plans, no, I plan on staying with the State Department until I retire, which is still quite a ways away. On the business side of it with Deep Creek, I want to move into being a developer. I'm looking to get, you know, a big piece of land, do like a 100, 120
a subdivision build or something like that.
A subdivision. Yeah, exactly. That's sort of the next thing that I want to get into. But that's probably a few years down the line. And actually I want to get back into what I started in, which is finance, and do a private equity investment fund, specifically in vacation properties. So we have a couple like things out there for the future.
You and I should chat because I've always had the idea that there should be, because, you know, like I invest in multifamily syndications and a lot of those are only for accredited investors, right? That, I mean, I can't remember what the numbers are exactly, but you have to have $1 million net worth, or you have to make, I think it's over, is it $200,000 or $250,000 a year, which, you know, most of the State Department employees, they don't make that kind of money or have those kinds of assets. And, you know, multifamily syndications, I think, are a really good vehicle for people that don't want to do active real estate investing, right? And so, you know, you're looking at anywhere from like 7 to 10% returns on your money. And sure, there are risks and, you know, there are some issues and you do have to like vet the sponsors very well. But right now, a lot of that, you know, all of those opportunities are closed to Foreign Service officers. So I've always thought it would be wonderful to have a fund, you know, whether it's in apartment buildings or pools of residential real estate that like Foreign Service officers who don't want to actively own rental property could do. But you and I, maybe we'll talk about that at some point, and who knows.
I'd love to.
But yeah, no, I think it's great because I really like your trajectory of how, you know, you started, you saw an opportunity, you weren't afraid to grab it and figure it out, and you just built on it, right? And you built over time because, I mean, I talk to a lot of people in the community who, you know, they're like, I want to be financially free in 2 years. And it's like, well, I mean, not that you couldn't do it, because probably there's some people that have, but a lot of this is building on, you know, what's the next step? What's the next step? It's like building, you know, a house. It's like you're putting one brick after the other. And I think your story is a really great example of, you know, you just kept going and you're like, oh, well, I can do this flip. Well, now I can do two. Now I can build. Now I can partner. Now I can have my own company. Now I'm going to, you know, build new construction. Now I'm going to develop whole subdivisions. I mean, like, you can see the trajectory from where you're going. And I mean, I think it's a wonderful story. I mean, you know, kudos to you. Bravo.
Thank you.
And it's great too, because, you know, like, there's so many, I think there's so many Foreign Service officers among us that have these amazing stories. And, you know, for our listeners out there, like, if you know of people, because Joe was actually referred to me by someone who shall remain nameless, but, you know, they were like, you really should have, you know, interview Joe. So for those of you listening, if you have people that you have heard their stories and you think that they are a good candidate for the podcast, please reach out. We'd be happy to talk to them. So, Joe, before we wrap up, you know, one last question. I think what piece of advice would you give to other Foreign Service officers or even people, you know, in the embassy community that are thinking of maybe doing the same thing? Because I don't think it's a new idea among our community to have kind of a vacation property. And people always want to, you know, make the numbers work. And I think they're always worried about, okay, well, you know, I buy the one property, maybe I Airbnb it or something. Given sort of current market conditions and your experience, I mean, what kind of advice would you have for people who are thinking about getting into vacation properties?
No, it's a great question, because you're right. It's a really difficult time to into a vacation properties in terms of a business. I mean, if you want to buy a vacation home and try to cover your costs, you can probably still do that today.
Yeah, there are really markets you can do it in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I, to be honest, I really only know Deep Creek. I can't speak to any other vacation homes. I pretty much limit myself to that market. But I think it's similar to most. At Deep Creek, a house that sold for $800,000 18 months ago, if it's lakefront, it's probably worth 2.2 today. And those rents have only gone up by about 10%, 20%. So there's just no way you're going to be able to really make that as an investment. I would say consider new construction. Find a builder who can build at a reasonable price, which is really very difficult.
Materials costs have gone up, right? And I don't know if they have stabilized. I mean, I'm hearing all kinds of things from contractors. I don't know if it's just an excuse to like mark up the price more, right, for the labor materials. Right. But it's tough right now because things are expensive.
Things are expensive, but also labor is expensive. I mean, I'm really seeing more inflation in labor than I'm seeing in material prices. And then some materials you just can't get up. You just can't get. We're doing a house with a flat roof. And flat roofs usually use a membrane called EPDM, which is like a rubber. It's 9 months out to get EPDM. Like, that's crazy. 9 months to get a rubber of shingle. So you have some problems with supply chain that are causing new builds. But I would
supply
say,
chain,
new builds are probably your best bet. But then also look at the amenities. Know the market, I guess, is probably my best piece of advice. What drives renters to your house? You need something these days. When I first got in 9 years ago, which isn't that long ago, if you had a big screen TV, that got people to your house. Well, that's laughable.
Oh, the
today,
days.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
It is. I'm laughing. Yes.
So those days are gone. Now you need at least a swimming pool, an indoor swimming pool. You want maybe a movie theater. We're designing a house right now that has an indoor water park with a lazy river. Like, those are the kind of things that bring people in.
What?
Yeah, it's going to be cool. That's what people want. Yeah, they want something they don't have at home. So I would say know your market. Find a property that you can develop for a reasonable price that will generate the kind of rents you want. And that's not easy to do. The other thing I'd maybe just say is maybe wait. This market is not going to last forever. I'm not a naysayer. I'm not generally a negative person by nature, but the prices we're seeing right now are unjustifiable in Deep Creek, and they're gonna come down at some point. And when they do, be ready to go.
I'm curious, because, you know, this is a topic of conversation in my office quite a bit too, because prices have increased across the board, across the United States, in literally almost all categories of housing, right? And you're talking specifically about vacation rentals. And I think vacation rentals are a very specific product at the moment that suddenly became, there was such a huge demand for the, you know, during the pandemic, because people needed space and they wanted to get away and they couldn't fly, right? So local vacation rentals became extremely popular and the prices got bid up. Mm-hmm. And I guess my question for you is, so you know, from your perspective, you think that the prices are not sustainable. And, you know, given your background in wealth management and finance, I'm curious what makes you say that. Is it just because you think people aren't going to be paying those prices? Because, I mean, given like sort of the inflationary environment right now and just a lot of the things that are happening in the economy, like pushing prices up and, you know, lower interest rates, right, for mortgages. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there is some stickiness on prices, because also too, you know, sellers, or buyers, they buy, you know, let's say, I don't know, a $2 million house, they aren't going to sell it for 1.5 in like 2 years, right? So I'm just sort of curious what sort of signs you're seeing that you might think, you know, that give you the idea the market might be unsustainable and that prices may drop. Mm-hmm.
So Deep Creek can be divided into sort of a couple different markets within Deep Creek. You have your lakefront homes, which have seen the highest increase by far. You have another group, which are more of your traditional entry-level homes at Deep Creek, which today, if you want a 3 or 4 bedroom little chalet in Deep Creek, you're looking at about $400,000 to $550,000. Those have increased, but not that much, by about 20%. I think those are probably relatively sustainable in that the rents have gone up enough to justify a 20% increase. And mm-hmm. a lot of people who are buying those are buying them as second homes. So they're buying them as traditional residential mortgages, meaning that they have to qualify based on their own personal income. So I think those are fine. The lakefront houses is where I think you're seeing just unjustifiable prices, because mm-hmm. a lot of those are based upon the rental income that they're generating. I'm seeing corporations coming in and buying them. I'm seeing REITs coming in and buying them. And they're basing it off of low interest rates that I don't think are going to last forever. I mean, we're in an inflationary, potentially spiral. I hope not, but an inflationary period, the Fed is tightening up monetary policy. I think you're going to see rates increase. I mean, I don't think anybody would disagree with that. And when those rates increase, a lot of these loans are on 5-year bubbles, balloons. So they don't have fixed interest rates. They're not like the second homes. And the rents are not justifiable by the purchase price. So mm-hmm. they're kind of buying them with the assumption that the rents are going to go up. And the rents are going to go up, but I just don't think they're going to go up enough to justify mm-hmm. the prices. So maybe they won't, maybe the prices won't decrease on the lakefront houses in a year or two. But I don't think
they'll just stagnate, maybe.
Yeah, I think they're going to stagnate. Mm-hmm. You know, I was talking about an $800,000 house is worth 2.2. What's even crazier is land. 16 months ago, a lakefront lot that was half an acre with 100 feet of lakefront was about $400,000 to $500,000. Today, it's about $1.3 million for an empty piece of land. It's crazy. So
no, but you know, I think, I mean, it's really interesting because, you know, we work with a lot of investors, and all investors right now are looking for returns, right? And mm-hmm. all the rates of return are being driven down because there's so much capital sloshing around mm-hmm. that it's trying to find productive uses. And real estate, you know, has traditionally been for a long time an asset class that people like. And so you're seeing rates of return for rental properties going down kind of across the board, you know, and you really have to get creative. And like you said, to go back to your piece of advice, really know your market or, you know, partner with somebody that does. Like, you've been working in Deep Creek now for, you know, almost 10 years and you've seen a lot of the ups and downs, and so is your business partner. And so I think it's important if anybody's considering, you know, launching into the market, to really get somebody with deep expertise that has seen more than one market cycle, right? I think that is really important. And also that understands the fundamentals like you're talking about, because a lot of people, they just come into a market, they're like, the property is great. And it's like, well, it is, but who is going to rent the property? And the who is so much more important sometimes, and especially in vacation rentals, because you aren't there, you're not using it as your primary residence. And so therefore, you know, if you are doing short-term rentals, you really have to understand what is driving demand. So, you know, your story about the big screen TV is very funny, actually, because I think, and I'm seeing this more and more at like real estate conferences that I'm going to, like I was just at the Bigger Pockets real estate conference in October in New Orleans, and a lot of the different, you know, sessions that they were having, a lot of people who have a lot of experience and are doing a lot of things all over the country are really focusing on sort of higher end, you know, apartment buildings, higher end, you know, sort of glamping experiences. And I don't know if it's, you know, people were talking about sort of this wave of, you know, kind of Instagrammable places, but I think that has, like, social media has driven a lot of these like really amazing retreats outside of the city, right? Like you're talking about indoor water park. I mean, it's mind blowing to think like you have to offer an indoor water park for people to pick your property versus somebody else's. But this is sort of a trend that I'm seeing in sort of conferences that I'm going to and kind of the buzz around the street. So I find it fascinating, but I think with that, I don't know if there's any other things that you want to say to our listeners, but it's been a wonderful interview, Joe. I think it's an amazing story. I'm really impressed with what you've managed to accomplish, you know, in the hours of like 7:30 to 11 part-time in the middle of Africa on your computer. And I think it's just a testament to what people can do when they put their mind to it. So, I mean, really, thanks so much for talking to us. And we really enjoyed hearing your story.
Thanks, Tanya. And thank you for doing this podcast. I really, when I first heard this was going on, I was like, wow, this is a great idea, because there are a lot of great sort of side hustles that foreign service officers are doing. And thank you for sharing all of these stories with all of us. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. And we'd be glad to, you know, hear from you again at some point down the road when you're developing and doing, you know, subdivisions and funds. But we'll let you have a couple years and then we'll invite you back and see what you're up to. But thanks so much for joining us, Joe. And listeners, be sure to like us and give us 5 stars, and we will be producing more wonderful content for you. And we'll see you next time.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.